Join me in Job chapter number 40 at verse number 15. We just got started on this section last time, but it's such an interesting section. I want to go back to the very first verse of it before we finish the rest of it. Now, you remember the overall context of the book of Job. Job has been put under a time of testing, which God knows he can handle. That's 1 Corinthians 15, 10:13 principle. But he's not aware that it's Satan that's doing this testing against him. And so he cries out, "Why? Why is this happening to me? If only God would just let me talk to him, ask him questions, find out why he's doing these things to me." So he's been saying that repeatedly throughout all the stuff he's said. And so now here at the end of the book, God comes and says, "Job, let me ask you questions first." And basically, he asked Job, "Do you understand what I've already done?" And he lays out here at what I believe is the climactic moment in his chiding of Job, his correction of Job. Job hasn't sinned, understand. He's just been very emotional in his response, and he's going to push the borders of the things that he's said about God. But God says, "Have you seen these animals? Have you considered these guys?" And so I do not believe that these are legendary animals, mythological animals. I think they're literal. I also do not like the footnotes that I've seen in some English translations, such as my New American Standard that I'm looking at right here, where they try to present these animals as if they were less significant than the way God is talking about them. I believe, need to see these as now extinct animals that were known in that ancient time period to people like Job. And Job would have been impressed with God's words about this animal. All right, enough of the preamble. Let's dive back into the text. Job 40, verse 15. "Behold, Behemoth." Now, Behemoth is just basically, I think it's a dual or a plural of the word for mute, meaning an animal that can't speak with human speech. But it is clearly a gigantic animal. So it's a big animal. The Greek Old Testament chooses to use the word theria, which is just the normal word for a wild animal, meaning not tame. The New American Standard that I mentioned a moment ago has chosen to put a footnote of the hippopotamus in its commentary about this animal. And my response, which you can kind of already hear in my voice, is, "You've got to be kidding me." First of all, hippopotamus is a Greek word. And so if that's what the Greek-speaking and Hebrew-speaking people that wrote the Septuagint thought this animal was, that's what would be in the text. But that is not what they chose to use. They chose to use a much more generic wild animal word. Besides which, when you look at the description of this animal, it ain't no hippopotamus. Let's keep going. "Behold, Behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox," so he's an herbivore, that's clear. "Behold his strength in his loins, his power in the muscles of his belly. So he's got very strong muscles in his chest and abdominal cavity. Now, I suppose you could say that that's true of a hippopotamus, but you can't say the next thing. Verse 17, he makes his tail stiff like a cedar. Stiff is probably not the best word here. His tail doesn't stand up like a cedar, or stand, as in generically, just be there like a cedar. Now keep in mind that the cedars that these guys knew about were the cedars of Lebanon, which are slightly smaller, but pretty much to be compared with our sequoias or our redwoods here in the United States. So it is a big, massive tree. And so there is no way a hippopotamus is in mind here because they don't have tails like that. There is an animal, extinct now, that certainly fits this category. And that would be any of the multitude of sauropods, the herbivore, four-footed, long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs. Now, those of you that have been around for a while with me, you already know that I believe that the evolutionary time scale of millions and millions of years is way off base, primarily because these guys do not take into account the flood and how all those sedimentary layers were set down in very short order. And so I believe that the dinosaurs and humans all lived at the exact same time. But I also believe in extinction processes that are still happening today. And so a lot of the dinosaur types, particularly the larger ones that existed before the flood, lost a lot of habitat and lost in the fight against human encroachment on their regions over time, hunting, for example, against them. But here in this time period, I believe there was at least a few of these big sauropods still left. And why did they get so big? Well, because they were long-lived. And so even after the flood, some of the sauropods that were represented, their kind represented in the ark, certainly would have gotten pretty good sized. And I think it's very likely that Job was familiar with at least a small portion of that category of large animal. All right, so he makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together, so he's very muscular. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. Now, I don't necessarily think that that Job would have been familiar with the inside of these bones. I think God is describing here, you understand, Job, that in order for a monster animal like that to exist, it has to have a very sturdy structure underneath, an undergirding. It has to have a good skeleton. And that's exactly what this guy has. He has strong tubes of bronze and limbs that are like bars of iron. Verse 19. To be very clear, he is the first of the works of God. Not meaning that he was the first one made, but he is the premier land animal. He is the premier example of God's creative design. And then let him who made him bring near his sword. In other words, only God can take this guy out. And so that does seem to describe one of these apatosaurs or one of these gigantosaurus or titanosaurs or what all the other names are for these gigantic varieties of sauropods. A little bit about his habitat. For the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. Now, it has been theorized for a very, very long time that these large sauropods would hang around in bodies of water to kind of help buoy up their mass and also avail themselves of a wide variety of vegetative matter that would be there inside or nearby that body of water. And so that's exactly where this animal is said to be. For his shade, the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brook surround him. So again, he's in a river system, sounds like, when he's carrying on his day-to-day life. But he is not worried about flood. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he's not frightened. He is confident, though Jordan rushes against his mouth. And so the mention of the Jordan River tells us, again, Job is in the general vicinity of the lower Middle East. He's in the region near the Promised Land. Now, Job, I suspect, is part of what will eventually become the Arab tribes of the Arabian Peninsula, descendants of Esau, descendants of the sons of Abraham and Keturah, and Abraham's son Ishmael. These guys, we know for a fact, early on and for the vast majority of their existence, made all sorts of trade travelings. They were traveling merchants, going on caravans all over the place, out of the upper portion of the Arabian Peninsula down to the southern portion of the Arabian Peninsula, from all over the peninsula into Egypt, up into Syria, up into Mesopotamia. So they were far-ranging and had experience all over the lower Middle East. So they would have been very familiar with Jordan, and I'm sure that Job knew the Jordan Valley pretty well from probably being involved in such travelers. When the Jordan Valley is at flood stage, it's got a really swift current, and it is quite wide. Even in this modern period, where there's a lot of water of the Jordan being tapped off by the population for use elsewhere in irrigation and things of that nature, there's still sufficient water to imagine what it would have been like at flood stage. And so if you've ever been in or around even a smaller river at flood stage, it's a scary thing because you can be swept away in an instant. But maybe you'll remember some of the floods after the recent hurricane, the videos of cars being swept away in those floodwaters. That's what we're talking about here, all of that energy. But for this guy, for Behemoth, psh, nothing. He don't care. Even if he dips down his head into those floodwaters in order to get a big bite of, I don't know, whatever vegetation is passing by, he doesn't care. He's confident. Verse 24, can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? This seems to be a rhetorical question, as in, do you honestly think that you could capture this guy? That we already know that God said, only I could take him down. And here, God says, what do you think? Do you really think that you could take this guy down? And what's the point? The point is, Behemoth was made by God. So, Job, do you understand the ramifications of that? Are you on a level to honestly engage in serious debate and what's the word we've been wanting to use? The deposing in a court of law, the one who made that sort of creature. Do you think you're up to asking questions of me? Now, God's not done. Chapter 41, he shifts from this massive land animal that he'd made to this massive sea monster that he'd made. Verse 1 of chapter 41, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Now, I go over to my New American Standard at this point, and guess what they put down as a footnote for what Leviathan or Leviathan is. They put crocodile. And again, I have to object. First of all, crocodile is a Greek word. So if the writers, the translators of Hebrew into Greek during the 3rd century BC thought that Leviathan was actually the Hebrew word for a crocodile, they would have used that word. They didn't. You want to know what word they used? They used the word dracona, which is where we get our word dragon. Dracon was the Greek way of expressing a very large reptilian in form creature. It might be like a snake, but then again, it might have limbs as well. And so it is a dragon, a sea dragon, that God is making reference here. Leviathan, the Hebrew word, has something to do with segmentation, which might be a reference to scales, or elongation, which might have the idea it's a super long animal. And so my guess is, and that's all it is that again, we're talking about some sort of now extinct dinosaur creature that was still known to the people of Job's day. Now, did Job ever see it himself? Maybe. I mean, I am convinced that some of Job's neighbors were seafarers along the Red Sea and down into the Indian Ocean, perhaps even beyond. Maybe he rode on some of those seafaring trade ships. But whether he had seen it himself or was just aware of it, he could certainly answer these rhetorical questions from God. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? The answer is no. Or press down his tongue with a cord. So are you going to like turn him into some sort of captured animal? No. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Again, these are common procedures that they used back at this time in order to capture and control certain animals, including, guess what? Crocodiles. You know, people have captured in ancient times crocodiles and turned them into, you know, I guess some sort of zoo specimen. They have also killed them with ancient weaponry. So God is not talking about crocodiles. He's talking about this sea monster. Verse 3, will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Meaning, and this is metaphorical and kind of a little bit tongue-in-cheek, will he Will he plead with you to let him go? Will he be kind in his pleadings to be set free? Verse 4, will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? You know, will he say, please don't kill me. I'll be nice. I'll be good. I'll behave myself as your pet. Verse number 5. Oh, by the way, the answer to those are no, he's not going to do that. Will you play with him as with a bird? Is he going to be like some sort of parrot? Or maybe your little pet duck or your peacock in your garden? No, he's not. Will you put him on a leash for your girls? The answer, no. You don't turn a gigantic dragon into a pet for your kids. Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? And no, they won't. Even though they did do that with lots of animals and animal products. Verse 7. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Now, we know that they did that with crocodiles. I just mentioned that a while ago. They actually killed hippopotami, and they even, in ancient times, whaled, attacked, killed, butchered, and used gigantic whales. But God says, you're not going to be able to do that with this guy. Verse 8, lay your hands on him and remember the battle. You will not do it again. So even if you tried it, you would regret it, and you, if you survive the encounter, would not repeat the attempt. So we are definitely talking about another one of God's premier animals. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. So the idea that you might actually take one of these animals or kill one of these animals is a goofy idea. It is false. And the reality is that even spotting him as you are cruising along in your ship is a scary thing, because he is so big and so stupendous in his formation by God. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Now we've gotten to the point, right? If the creatures of God, Behemoth, Leviathan, are so awe-inspiring, and we use that word awe in its proper form, fear-inspiring, if these two creatures, one on the land, one on the sea, is so absolutely terrifying to humans, imagine what their creator must be like. How awesome he is, and how you should think twice before saying things like, I think you need to come into court and answer my questions, which is what Job had actually said. Now, we understand, I've mentioned this many times, he is driven emotionally here. And so he is not hateful and spiteful toward God. He is just frustrated and at his wit's end. But he did say the words, and so God responds to those words. Verse 11, who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. So a little reminder again, God is creator. He doesn't owe anyone anything. In fact, the reality is he made everything, therefore he's the owner of everything. Verse 12, I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. So God's gone back to talking a little bit more about Leviathan here. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with a bridle? So we're back to the idea of thinking that you can skin him out or take him into captivity. Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. So apparently got really sharp teeth in that gigantic mouth. His back is made of rows of shields shut up closely as with a seal. So he's a scaly creature. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. So he is watertight, he is airtight with his scaly skin, the way that it's designed. The next part is quite intriguing to me, and I'm going to do a little song and dance here to kind of hold this until our next time together. One of the things that comes up in a lot of dragon mythology, and I use that word mythology advisedly here, is that many of them breathe fire. And guess what? This dragon is pictured by God as having the ability to breathe fire. And when we next get back together, I am going to suggest to you some things that you'll see on creationist websites that this is not beyond the realm of possibility.